This is an AMI podcast.
Hey there, this is Kelly MacDonald, co-host of Kelly & Company on AMI Audio. On our show, we talk about the events and happenings that are relevant to the blind and partially sighted community across Canada. With the help of our regional contributors, we'll keep you up to date on what's happening in your community so you don't miss out. So give Kelly & Company a try and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Description Deep Dive, the James Bond Files, where we explore the visual world of 007. Here, we'll flesh out the characters, visit the exotic locations, test out the gadgets, and talk tropes and cliches from all 25 official Bond films. I'm your describer and host, JJ Hunt. Welcome.
Yeah, baby! Yeah.
So far in this series, we've described the Sean Connery era and the Roger Moore era, and we've shown Lazenby a bit of love, too. In this episode, we're going to focus on Timothy Dalton, who helmed the franchise in the late 80s, and Pierce Brosnan, who carried the Bond torch through the 90s and into the next millennium. For Dalton, that's The Living Daylights, released in 1987, and License to Kill from 1989. And from Brosnan, we have GoldenEye from 1995, Tomorrow Never Dies from 97, 1999's The World Is Not Enough, and finally, Die Another Day, released in 2002. In the same way that Moore was considered for the role of Bond years before he was hired, both Dalton and Brosnan had been on the producers' radars for some time. Dalton was primarily a theater and BBC actor, and had been first considered for the part during Connery's run, perhaps even before Lazenby was cast. But Dalton felt he was too young and didn't fancy stepping directly into Connery's shoes, so producers put him on a maybe someday list. Years later, when Moore's time was winding down, a hot young Irish-American actor named Pierce Brosnan caught the attention of Bond producers. But as with Moore and The Saint, Brosnan's hit TV show Remington Steele had him locked into a contract. So Dalton got the part, and Brosnan took his spot on the someday list. The Dalton-Brosnan years can be thought of as a unified period, a time when the series was transitioning into what we currently think of as the modern era. But they are very different Bonds, and their films are quite different too. We'll dive into that in a minute, but first, let's describe our new heroes, Timothy Dalton and Pierce Brosnan. Timothy Dalton was a tall, slight man, with dark brown hair worn thick but neat, and a slight widow's peak that was visible when his hair was combed back, not parted on the side. He had a somewhat angular face with a strong jawline, a cleft chin, and dimple lines on both cheeks. His narrow green eyes sit beneath thick dark brows and often lock on fellow actors with considerable intensity. Brosnan was similarly tall, dark, and handsome, but had a more athletic build than Timothy Dalton. His dark hair was often gelled back, exaggerating his heart-shaped face, but a few locks usually sprang out to tickle his wrinkled forehead. While Dalton's intense gaze was seemingly unending, Brosnan's was used more sparingly. At his most serious, he would knit his brow and narrow and tighten his lips, but as often as not, there was a slight smirk at the corner of his mouth and in his eyes, perhaps a playful interpretation of the character, or perhaps an acknowledgement from the actor that he's kind of in on the joke. In the late 80s and early 90s, all of the main supporting roles were recast. The original M, Bernard Lee, had passed away in 1981, and Robert Brown had taken over in 83. Balding, with bushy brows and a hound dog scowl, Brown held the role through the end of Moore's run and for both of Dalton's films, too. But for 1995's GoldenEye, the producers decided to mix things up. The eminent Dame Judi Dench was brought in to play M in one of the great casting triumphs of popular cinema. Dench was a grande dame of the English stage, but her film career was just getting rolling. She was over 60, but all 7 of her Academy Award nominations were still ahead of her. Judi Dench was 5'1", with a small, somewhat boxy frame. She had short gray hair that turned silver over her tenure, and wrinkles around her eyes, upper lip, and neck that grew deeper with time. As M, she's largely tight-lipped and rarely smiles, and her glare is so powerful that her penciled-in eyebrows needn't knit a stitch to send chills through a fellow actor. It's long been understood that Dench's interpretation of the character is actually based on Stella Rimington, the real-life head of MI5 from 1992 to 1996. Canadian Lois Maxwell was the original Miss Moneypenny and held the role for the first 14 films in the series. But the character is predicated on a flirty relationship with Vaughn. And while older men chasing younger women is very much desired by Hollywood, older women chasing younger men, sadly, not so much. So when 41-year-old Timothy Dalton took the lead, 58-year-old Lois Maxwell was out of a job. In Dalton's The Living Daylights and License to Kill, Caroline Bliss played the part. Pretty and blonde, with thin lips, a kind smile, and large round glasses, she was a rather spot-on 1980s sexy secretary with girl-next-door good looks. But the role changed hands again when Brosnan and Dench came on board. Producers hired an accomplished actor, Samantha Bond, no relation, who had a robust career on stage and with the BBC. She had red hair, often cut stylishly short, arching, sculpted eyebrows, and pale blue eyes. Her flirty relationship with 007 was perhaps more mature and definitely more in keeping with the times, leading to a genuinely sexy and funny scene in Die Another Day that I really shouldn't spoil for you.
Aww.
No actor in the franchise lasted as long as the original Q, Desmond Llewellyn. He was quartermaster to Connery, Lazenby, Moore, Dalton, and Brosnan. In 1999's The World Is Not Enough, producers had Llewellyn introduce his apprentice, R, played by Monty Python alum John Cleese, with his great height, puffed-out chest, graying hair, and matching mustache. Llewellyn hints at his retirement and is given a small send-off as Brosnan watches him drop down through the floor on a hidden lift. But the producers hadn't actually said that they were retiring the character, and Llewellyn himself was on the record as saying, "I will play Q as long as God lets me." Sadly, in December of 1999, with The World Is Not Enough still in theaters, Llewellyn was involved in a head-on collision. He died at the age of 85. Every time a new actor takes over as Bond, the producers have an opportunity to refresh and even reinvent the franchise. And they certainly took advantage of that opportunity with the switch from Moore to Dalton. Moore's Bond had become almost cartoonish. His films had taken the campiness from the Connery movies and turned it into something more akin to goofball comedy. So much so that Moore very successfully played a version of himself in the Burt Reynolds car chase comedy Cannonball Run. Dalton and the producers were eager to switch gears, so they crafted a new Bond world that was more in keeping with the action movies of the day, like Sylvester Stallone's First Blood or Bruce Willis's Die Hard. These were one-man-against-the-world action films, where the comedy takes a back seat to brutal fight scenes and big explosions. The idea was to bring the Bond character back to his roots, the original Ian Fleming novels. That 007 was a proper ruthless spy who's good with his fists and great with a gun, but dark and jaded after years of life as a government assassin. Dalton was the perfect actor for this version of the character. There's a coldness in his green eyes and malice in his smile, and his demeanor is far more serious than playful. Plus, he could do most of his own stunts, which added more realism to the action scenes. The supporting characters were similarly hard and serious. It was out with comical villainy and in with more genuine villains. In License to Kill, Bond tangles with drug kingpin Franz Sanchez, played by 1980s heavy Robert Davi, best known as the opera-singing bad guy from Goonies. Davi is a tall, strapping man with dark, brushed-back hair and low, dark eyebrows that arch over deep-set eyes. He has significant wrinkles on his high forehead, deep dimple lines on his cheeks, and skin that's heavily pocked with acne scars. But aside from an iguana that he kept on his shoulder in a couple of scenes, he's got no goofy affectations or laughable delusions of grandeur like earlier Bond villains. He's nasty and violent, mutilating, whipping, and killing people in brutal ways that were quite unusual for a Bond movie. There's a decent amount of blood in License to Kill, too, something that the filmmakers had shied away from in the past. One of Sanchez's trusted henchmen is Dario, played by 21-year-old Benicio del Toro in one of his first film roles. Del Toro is young and beautiful, with smooth golden skin, wavy black hair, large almond-shaped eyes, high cheekbones, and full lips. He might be a pretty boy, but he played the part with the same ferocity that made him famous in later films like The Usual Suspects, Sin City, and Sicario. This gritty shift in the series did have its fans, but it wasn't overly successful at the box office. And to complicate matters, the franchise was put on hold for 5 full years so that the producers could deal with more legal issues. So when the time finally came to make the next film, they decided once again to switch Bonds, and Pierce Brosnan got the call. His first film, GoldenEye, was released in 1995, and I have to say, it's a great movie. Oh, it has some serious faults, but to so successfully pay homage to the Bond movies of the past and set the stage for the Bond films of the future in one pitch-perfect action comedy, it was a very tall order. And they filled it brilliantly. The filmmakers laid it all out in the film's very first scene. GoldenEye opens with a moving camera shot of a small plane flying over an enormous gray concrete dam, 720 feet tall and over 1,200 feet long. The scale, the color, the stark, flat expanse of concrete imposing its will on the river and valley. If Blofeld was a structural engineer, this would be his masterpiece. A figure in black sprints along the top of the gently curving dam with a looped rope slung across his chest. When he reaches the middle, he hooks a carabiner onto the railing and another onto a leather strap secured to his boot. As we peer down from above, the man stands on a concrete precipice, spreads his arms, and swan dives over the front of the dam toward the jagged, blackened rocks of the dry riverbed below. The filmmakers switch camera angles, giving us both a wide shot and an extreme wide shot, which shows off the man in black's swan dive form and the vast, dirty concrete dam behind him. The man in black falls a full 10 seconds, before the bungee rope secured to his ankles begins to snap taut. He pulls out a harnessed pistol, aims it down, and fires before his descent is complete. A tethered grappling hook buries itself in the concrete roof of an entrance at the base of the dam, and the man in black reels himself in. We haven't had a word of dialogue or even seen the new Bond's face, but he's already completed a jaw-dropping, record-breaking stunt to end all stunts, and did it in a setting that made us feel like we were back in the golden age of the franchise. In the first 20 minutes of GoldenEye, we get several outstanding action sequences, an Aston Martin red Ferrari car chase, and Brosnan's Bond in a tuxedo, in a casino, saying his name and ordering a martini while chatting up Xenia on a top. As gorgeous a femme fatale as you'll find in any Bond era. But this isn't just a throwback movie. It recontextualizes the franchise, too. While sipping a bourbon at her desk, Judi Dench's M calls Bond out on his behavior, labeling him a sexist, misogynist dinosaur, which creates some genuine tension, adds depth to both characters, and launches Bond into a modern era, there's lots of conflict and intrigue within MI6 in the Brosnan years, which helps break up the rigid plot structure of the early films and sets the stage for Daniel Craig's films, too. This is what I mean by modernizing the franchise. The Brosnan era keeps the tropes we love, but presents them in a way that makes sense to a modern audience. Bond can still be a womanizing, hard-drinking spy, but moving forward, the films will at least hint at motivations and repercussions. And we can still have outrageous, megalomaniacal supervillains, but now they'll get enough of a backstory for modern audiences to suspend disbelief. Like Renard from The World Is Not Enough, played by the usually fantastic Robert Carlyle. He's a small, slight white man with dark stubble on his pale-shaved head, thin lips, a small chin, and a drooping right eye with a heavy lid, caused by a bullet that entered his skull at the temple and never came out, leaving him immune to pain and apparently messing with his Russian accent.
I like it! I like it!
Or Zhao from Die Another Day, played by the incredibly handsome Korean-American actor Rick Yoon. In an early scene, the tall, muscular man stands too close to an exploding suitcase full of diamonds, which embed themselves in his face like tiny, streaking comets. In the modern era, the women of Bond finally get more meaningful screen time. Of course, Bond girls still need to be gorgeous and sexy, but now they're part of the story, too. In Tomorrow Never Dies, Brosnan teams up with Michelle Yeoh, a Malaysian actress famous for her mastery of cinematic martial arts and doing her own stunts in a string of Hong Kong action films. Yeoh is a handsome, fit, small woman with long dark hair, muscular arms, and a suite of skills that would easily earn her a 00 ranking. And how about Brosnan's Die Another Day co-star, Halle Berry, as Jinx? When we first meet the undercover spy, she's rising out of the Cuban surf, wearing a pumpkin orange string bikini top and a white knife belt across her hips. A clear callback to Honey Rider, the first Bond girl from Dr. No. Berry, a stunning brown-eyed, light-skinned black woman, runs her fingers through her short black hair and sashays out of the water, swinging her hips like a church bell on Sunday. There were a few notable Bond women misses in the Brosnan years, though, like The World Is Not Enough's Christmas Jones, played by Denise Richards. Jones is a doctor of nuclear physics, but they costume her in tight little shorts, work boots with rolled-down wool socks, and a breast-enhancing army green tank top. She looks like a 20-year-old college girl in a Tomb Raider Halloween costume. Between her limited acting range and the incongruous crop top, it's a bit difficult to take Richards seriously when she starts spouting clunky science babble. In the modern era, the filmmakers needed new plot-driven excuses for their villains' fantastic lairs. In License to Kill, Sanchez takes his potential cartel partners to his drug distribution center, which is housed in a televangelist's meditation retreat. Instead of building an exterior set, the filmmakers borrowed a real-life ceremonial center in the mountains outside of Mexico City, used for ritual celebrations by the Otomi people. The center, which was completed in 1980, features a vast stone courtyard, dozens of totemic statues, and a long row of curious conical structures, which are also built out of stone. In Die Another Day, diamond magnate Gustav Graves holds an exclusive event at the Ice Palace, a grand hotel built entirely of ice and snow. There are actual ice hotels in real life, including ones in Sweden and Quebec, but of course, the design of the Bond version is impossibly grandiose. The Ice Palace exterior borrows its layers of domed shells straight from the Sydney Opera House. And the arches over the lobby entrance, they're replicas of the Gateway Arch in St. Louis. Inside is an expansive lobby bar with floors, walls, and arched support beams built with fake luminous blue ice. And GoldenEye's climax takes place at a giant satellite facility hidden in the wilds of Cuba. The Bond crew went to an actual radio telescope in Puerto Rico to film those impressive scenes. The enormous main dish is precisely 1,000 feet across and is built in a depression left by a massive sinkhole, surrounded by lush green rainforest. Suspended almost 500 feet above the dish by steel cables is a steering mechanism attached to a series of catwalks, trusses, and girders, which normally supports the receiver, but is also handy for dangling spies and villains. The release of Brosnan's Die Another Day marked the 40th anniversary of the franchise, and as a treat for true fans, the producers included over 100 references to previous Bond films. The references, which these days are commonly known as Easter eggs, are peppered throughout the movie in costumes, props, and lines of dialogue. For example, several early Bond gadgets can be glimpsed in Q's underground development facility. I spotted the microjet and crocodile submarine from Octopussy, the briefcase and shoe daggers used in From Russia with Love, the jetpack from Thunderball, and a few old props like a red phone used by M's Russian counterpart in For Your Eyes Only, and even some small bubble-like computer monitors from back in Blofeld's early days. And then, after all those throwbacks, John Cleese introduces us to the newest addition to the Bond arsenal. An invisible Aston Martin. This was one of the big computer-generated effects that the producers were really keen on, but Bond fans weren't really buying. In some scenes, the actors just stared at a blank spot on the set, talking about the car that wasn't really there. In other shots, the car moves like a ghost, its outline causing a ripple in the film. The visual effect was all right, but many felt it was too absurd and over the top. Even for Bond. The other CGI dud was the rather unconvincing green screen action in the kite-boarding tsunami scene. When green screen is done well, it's almost seamless. But when it's bad, yeesh. With green screen tech, the performers act in front of a bright apple green screen, and then later, a computer swaps out that exact shade of green for another image or video. It's fairly easy to do, but hard to do well. And when it doesn't work, it just looks off. There are many ways for green screen to fall flat. If the lighting doesn't match, or if the actor was filmed inside but the background is filmed outdoors. If the shadows are wrong, or if the transition or edging between the foreground actor and background video are too blurry or too sharp. Any of those things can make green screen look weird. In the kiteboarding scene, several of those issues are at play. The lighting, the edging, the shadows, and the background itself is largely CGI. Brosnan's obviously riding a fake wave dotted with computer-generated icebergs. It's so unconvincing that sighted audiences can't suspend their disbelief, and the movie magic is blown. In our first episode, we talked about on-screen kissing, and how different it looked in those early movies from the 1960s. By the Dalton and Brosnan era, in the late 80s and 90s, things had really changed. To begin with, the Motion Picture Production Code and its rules about excessive and lustful kissing was abandoned in 1968 and replaced with the rating system we know today. With each Bond movie after that, the kissing grew a bit more passionate. But even in the Moore era, kisses were usually without tongue, and sex itself was rarely shown. Instead, it was alluded to, with trails of discarded evening gowns and tuxedos leading to Bond and a lover, making smoochy pillow talk beneath the covers. Moore had more lovers than any other Bond, but 007's libidinous ways were put on hold for Dalton. The 80s was a tricky time to be a free-loving spy. In 1987, when The Living Daylights was released, the AIDS epidemic was at its peak, so the filmmakers decided not to show Bond with multiple lovers. Dalton shares a few on-screen kisses with potential love interests, but no sex scenes are included in the final edits. By 1995, when Brosnan took over, the audience was eager for sex scenes, and producers could get away with lots and still keep its PG-13 rating. In GoldenEye, Famke Janssen's Onatopp is a hungry, vigorous lover with deadly appetites. In an early scene, wearing bright red lipstick, a black bustier, and garters, she straddles a barrel-chested man, sweating, growling, and burying her fingernails in his meaty chest. She then flips him over between her legs and, biting her lower lip, squeezes him to death with her stockinged thighs. And in Die Another Day, the first romantic encounter between Bond and Jinx is cleverly filmed so that it both is and decidedly isn't left to the audience's imagination. In a dark room, Barry and Brosnan are filmed in close-up, silhouetted in profile against blue sheer curtains. Keeping the cameras on their eager and lustful expressions, the filmmakers present us with the final 30 seconds of their deeply passionate lovemaking. Connery's closed-mouth face-mashing, it ain't. The Dalton-Brosnan era managed to take every element of action movie filmmaking and, in the parlance of the time, kick it up a notch.
Bam!
The stunts were more extraordinary, the chases increasingly involved, the plots more elaborate, the CGI over the top, and the sex far more explicit. So where could the 40-year-old series go from here? The Dalton-Brosnan era had started the modernization of the franchise, but with Die Another Day, had it gone too far? Was the franchise bloated and destined to collapse under its own weight? Did it need to scale back and simplify? It seemed like it might be the morning after for 007, with Bond sore and spent, flopped across his hotel bed, nursing a wicked martini and champagne hangover. Lucky for him, the phone rang with a franchise-changing wake-up call from another assassin with a license to kill, the new secret agent on the block, Jason Bourne. Description Deep Dive, The James Bond Files, is written, recorded, and produced by me, J.J. Hunt, with production assistance from Sam Robinson. Thanks to AMI's Media Accessibility Services team, as well as Andrew Morris for their support. The manager of AMI Audio is Andy Frank. If you're enjoying this deep dive into audio description, we want to hear about it. You can find us on Twitter at AMI Audio or hit me up directly at HeyHeyDoubleJ. Next time, on the final episode of the James Bond Files, we're going to examine the impact of Jason Bourne on James Bond, the stylish new visuals of modern fight and action scenes, and of course, Daniel Craig as the new 007. Until then, my friends.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.